I'm going to test out how loudly I need to project. I'm going to warn you that I have a bit of a sore throat, so we're going to do our best. And if at any point I'm not projecting loud enough, you will let me know, okay? So we're going to be looking at the story today of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. This is a story that I suspect a couple people in the room may have learned before. Perhaps there's also a couple of you that haven't learned this before. It's a little bit crazy to teach this story in a sense, because so many people have learned this story before, and everyone feels a little bit like been there and done that. And yet, miraculously, so many of you have showed up in this room today. And so I applaud you on that. Thank you for taking a chance on the story. The reason why we're learning this story, besides that I think it's a phenomenal story, is that I think the story is more complicated than we think it is. So sort of the overall, for those that we haven't learned the story yet before, the overall idea is that because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, the temple was destroyed, the second temple. And so the question I want to ask you to investigate during this session is, who is really responsible for the destruction of the second temple, right? The sort of the thesis of the story in the Gemara is because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, the temple was destroyed. But was it really Kamsa, Bar Kamsa? Was it really even Kamsa at all? What was Kamsa's role in the destruction? Or perhaps it was someone else. That I'm going to suggest that it's not such a simple answer, and that in fact, just in the Gemara itself, if you just stick to the story of the Gemara itself already gives three different answers of who's responsible for the destruction. And I think that there are even more possible possible answers to that. And so what we're gonna do today is we're gonna go back to the story. We're gonna read it again, and I really want you to think about the question, who's really responsible for the destruction? And based on the different answers you come up with, if it's Kamsa Bar Kamsa, if it's someone else, if it's this group of people, what does that flaw that led to the destruction, what can we learn about that in terms of virtue? What can we learn about that in terms of how do our interactions in the world affect the type of people we want to be, okay? So let's try again with a story. Who's with me? Yeah. Rousing, a rousing interest. So we have a bit of time together. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to send you into Chavruta, so you're going to be doing this in paired learning. I'm going to say, I think about 20 minutes, but depending on how it's going, I'll check in with you, see if you want to do more or less time. And then we have, I think, I hope, some really good later sources to look at that I think are going to bring some different perspectives to a text that some of you may have seen before. So take 20 minutes. I'm going to start passing around texts with the help of, thank you. So those texts are going to come around. You have the story. I just want to note, the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa is actually, it's quite a long text, so take your time with it. It's a juicy text. You know, I once learned that in terms of teaching a poetry class, that the way to really learn and teach poetry is to investigate every single line of poetry, not to take anything for granted. And I think the Gemara can be a little bit like that, that if you just read this whole story as a big, long wash, a lot of the details are going to get lost. But if you investigate every section of the Gemara and really ask yourself what's going on, I think there's a lot to be learned. So you have the text in front of you. I do have a few questions at the end just to help guide your text. What are the different possible causes for the destruction of the temple? That's the main question of this class. What are the different possible causes? What does the text mean when it says Kamsa and Bar Kamsa are responsible? Also ask yourself, anytime the Gemara is bringing a verse, the opening part of the sugya of this text is going to begin with a verse. Ask yourself, how does the verse relate to the rest of the story? It's very easy to lose the opening verse in relation to the rest of the story. What is the connection of the verse to the story? And of course, the overall question of the day is, what does this text teach us about virtue and what it means to live in interaction? Amazing. Okay, so Listen, I just want to say that you surpassed their expectations of me. We ran out of photocopies. They were like, she's not going to get however many. So thank you for being here, really. It was such an amazing din of learning in this room, and that is such an incredible thing on a Wednesday morning. So the first thing that I want to just ask you is, what came up in your chavruta? What was interesting? What did you notice about the story, whether you were encountering it for the first time, whether you've learned the story multiple times before? What came up on this learning for you? Yeah.
I know you have like a set question, so I feel like I left this text with more questions.
What are the more questions you have?
Huh?
What are the new questions you have?
My questions are like questions about the questions. So
I want to hear them. What are they?
I don't know. I didn't write them down. I feel like it's very hard to like look at this in such a simplistic way. And it's so, like, for me, this is my first time reading this.
Yeah.
And we struggled a lot without, like, context. I felt like there's so much more going on than, like, in the actual text.
Uh-huh.
Like, so much more backstory.
Great.
That it was very difficult to, like, I feel like you could answer this question in, like, a million different ways.
Uh-huh.
And I think the way we chose to answer it was just to, like, ask more and more and more questions.
Great.
And it's just, like, a very interesting way. So.
Sounds very Jewish of you. A very Jewish response. Yes, sir.
Questions too. I didn't understand the opening quotation.
Yes.
Something about and being fearful, yet the liar is criticized for being for his anivus, not for being. I didn't quite understand what anivus meant in this context.
Yes. Okay, so you're raising two very interesting questions. One is, what is the connection of the opening verse from Proverbs? And the second is, how do we translate that anava, that anavut, how do we translate that word of Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulis? Yes. So those are both great questions. So let's take the first one. So as far as the opening verse, so we're in the very beginning paragraph. Ashrei adam mifached tamid umakshe libo yipol bera'ah. So the translation here is, let me just say a note about the translation. I'm sorry, I should have said this at the top. Let me say two notes. Both of them are apologetic. Don't apologize for yourself. So the first is that you have the wrong citation. This is horrible. It is not 45B to 46A. It's 55B to 56A. If you want to learn this text on your own, make sure you make a note. This is the wrong citation for the text. 55B to 56A. So that's huge. The second thing is, the English translation you have is taken from Sepharia. So this is like the translation that's in the Steinsaltz. So what is helpful about this is the Steinsaltz translation wants to like fill in and give you a really smooth, easy reading experience. But what you'll notice, if for those of you that were comparing to the Hebrew or to the Aramaic, is it's filling in and adding a lot, some of which is interpretation. So normally on Sepharia, it's bolded, the sort of the more literal and the rest. And when these were made into source sheets, that was lost. So I want to give you that disclaimer. If you were reading the English, I hope it was nice reading for you, but you also were getting sort of commentary built into your reading experience. Okay, that's all to say, back to the translation of that quote at the beginning. Happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief. What is the connection of that verse to the rest of the story? A very good question. Yeah. Any thoughts?
It connects everything.
Tell me how.
Well, number one, that, you know, they threw the, you know, they threw the guy out of the place. And so the guy throwing the guy out of the place, Hamza, his heart was hardened.
Right, so the host who throws him out, he's hardening his heart, that he won't, under any circumstances, let him stay. Great, keep going.
And then, being humiliated, he got vindictive.
Yeah.
And then everybody that was a witness that didn't try to do something, their hearts were hardened too.
Great.
So everything fell apart. It's terrible.
And everything fell apart. And the temple was destroyed. Yeah, in the back.
And also, we were talking about fear. The man who fears, at the end, the rabbis forbade the sacrifice. I don't have an opinion about that, but they could not imagine that the temple was going to fall. In other words, when you're in the middle of a situation and you're tied to your institution, your values, your everything, you cannot imagine that not sacrificing, not caring is going to destroy the temple? You can't.
Yeah.
If you're in the, well, maybe you can, but in this case, they couldn't.
And so, no, you're making 100%. And so, what's the next step? Are you suggesting that they should have perhaps been more fearful or aware of the possible consequences of their actions?
They should have been more paranoid.
They should have been more paranoid. Okay, yeah.
To pick up on your comment, they feared one side of the consequences. They feared the implications if they allowed the sacrifice, what it would mean to future people witnessing it. But they didn't weigh the other side.
Right.
They didn't fear the consequences of not accepting.
Right.
Right.
Great. Yes, in the middle.
But there's an irony here because they feared the appearance of what they were doing, but if the guy at the beginning had feared the appearance of walking him out of the banquet, then we wouldn't be where we were to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Okay, yes.
So all of this deals with unintended consequences. And when you do something, you just think of the moment what the reaction will be, but you don't fast forward as to what all the things that can really happen.
Great, and that very much connects us back to that beginning, that opening verse.
At the beginning when the host kicked him out.
Yeah.
Or you could say when the servant, but you can't really blame it on the servant. When the servant got it wrong and picked the wrong person.
Right.
Plus there's another thing. Why did this Barkhamsa even want to go?
Yeah, we're going to look at a really great source on that. We're going to look at such a good source on that. Hold on to that question. Yeah, if Barkhamsa knows that he's this guy's enemy, and it's not clear to me if, certainly I think he knows that he's this guy's enemy, but if the host is also his enemy in terms of like why he would accept the invitation, yeah, like why does he go? Great question, hold on to that. So let's do one and then two, yeah.
I'm thinking about this question of who is afraid in the verse. The only person who's afraid, actually afraid, that is not scrupulous about consequences to others, but afraid, which to me usually implies for yourself, is and benefits from it, is Nero. That's super weird, right?
Yeah.
And he's fearful. He double checks his fear. He triple checks his fear. He says, no, I have reason to be afraid on a long-term basis. Acts more virtuously on the basis of it, and everyone comes out ahead in that narrow place. That just seems so out of left field to me.
That felt like the
fulcrum between people who are afraid or anxious or whatever, and it inhibits them from acting in a force-headed way, and people who are afraid in a way that impels them to act in a force-headed way. The fulcrum between those two things is set all the way far to one end of the story.
Yeah.
And that was very surprising balance to me.
Yeah, let's actually look at the Nero part of the story just because it's a strange little interlude, and I want to make sure we understand what's going on there. Do you think you could maybe sort of like summarize how you understand what's going on in those couple of paragraphs?
Yes.
What are all of the strange things he's doing with the arrows? What's going on there?
He's a Roman, so he's doing divination to check what's my plan as a general.
Mm-hmm.
And his first divination practice is to shoot arrows in all kinds of random directions because they're going to, like the Ouija board, they're going to point him to where he needs to go. And wherever he shoots the arrows, they all point to Jerusalem.
Right.
So he says, okay, the fates are pushing me to Jerusalem. Then he says, I'm going to double check with the second kind of divination to see how's that going to go?
Yeah.
And so he does effectively the like stick your finger in the pin in a pin place, and he does it by saying, or to a random kid, what random verse did you learn on this random day?
Yeah.
And the kid says, Edom will be destroyed.
Right.
And he says, this is not going to go well. And he, on the basis of these effectively sort of pagan divinatory practices, he says, actually, God does want me to do it, and yet will punish me, and so I'm not going to go. I'm going to convert to Judaism and start a new virtuous life as an entirely new person.
Yeah, amazing. And I think that you're so right to point out that, yeah, that Nero, actually the non-Jew in the story, does seem to be exhibiting more fear or awareness of the consequences of his actions than anyone else. And in a story in which I think you could ultimately argue that it seems like everyone was responsible for the destruction of the temple, all these different characters could have done something differently and perhaps prevented the situation. The one guy that like really, I mean, what did he like so much doesn't want this destruction to happen that he converts is actually the non-Jew in the story. Yes.
On the point of unintended consequences, there is a lot of then if you do again, if you don't sort of thinking, right? Like it's, or just acting thoughtlessly, like I'm gonna take this guy out because I'm annoyed, right?
Yeah.
But never expecting that the eventual result of that is going to be the destruction of the temple, right? And all the rest. Or in the case of the Kohanim, right, we can do it or we can't do it. It's a difficult situation either way. But there is one person who's putting their finger on the scale at every moment. There is deception in the story that is trying to create some kind of result, and that's Bar Kamsa, right? Bar Kamsa specifically says that there is going to be, right, a revolt, right? It goes to, it becomes an informant. Now, it's not clear if there was actual discussion of revolution or revolt within that feast, but for whatever reason, he mentions that specifically to the emperor. And then more to the point, later, when he says, here's the test to bring, he sabotages the sacrifice.
Yeah.
Right? These actions are, from a legal standpoint, right, these kind of transcend anything else that's happened. If causation was already in motion, uh-huh, right, this creates what's called a proximate cause, right? This is the reason more than anything else that uh-huh they find themselves in the situation they're in. And that's, you know, it changes the whole story, right? It's transformation.
Great. Okay, good. Thank you for that comment. Yeah, David.
Yeah, and even to put an even final point on that, what Bar Kamsa is most offended by the sages not protesting what happened. His anger is not even directed at Kamsa, but since the sages were sitting there and they did not protest, then they were content with it. Therefore, I will go and inform on them. So he's not, it's the silent bystanders that actually seem to offend him more than the person that picked him up and threw him out of the party.
I think you're right, but what do you think about that? It sounds like, almost like you're saying that's a less legitimate cause.
No, well, I think you can make an argument that it is a more legitimate cause. That,
yeah.
That you know, there's the people that actively hate me and are out to damage me. Nothing I can maybe do about that. They're irrational, they hate me. But then there's all the other people that could have intervened when I was being attacked and didn't and stayed silent. And those are the people that my ire is really directed towards. Those are the people that are in a way more responsible for the damage done to me, because the person that hates me hates me. But all the people that didn't say anything, well, I don't know if they hate me or not, but they're willing to stand by and let me get thrown out of the party for no fault of my own.
Yeah.
So that to me, you know, I could easily see why I would be more angry at the bystander than the person that originally injured me.
Right, and perhaps it might not have been justified to bring about the downfall of all of Judaism because of this one guy, but if it's the rabbis who themselves are authorizing it, then that somehow justifies. Well, I gotta say, the real Rav Avi was like, don't worry, you will have more than enough to say. These guys love to talk, and like, you are incredible to learn with. Yeah.
Circling back to the problem that it starts with, the idea of the one who fears God is the one who succeeds in the end, but that's the good thing. The one who, of the three stories, the one who actually puts fear of God first is Nero, and everybody else who doesn't comes up short and seems to be the example for the destruction. So the rabbis in the how does this look and the whole thing with the sacrifice, there's no concern about how it reflects to God accepting the sacrifice. It's all about the perception from everyone else,
uh-huh,
which doesn't seem nearly as important.
Yeah, great, thank you. Yes?
Just to clarify. It was a certain man who had the feast. We don't know who that man is.
The host.
Yeah, he's a name, which is actually so interesting.
Because he has a friend Kamsa and an enemy Bar Kamsa. So
yes.
It wasn't the one who was having the feast.
No.
It was a certain man. So we don't know who that is.
Yes, and why isn't he the one who's responsible for the downfall of destruction?
We also don't know what Bar Kamsa did.
What Bar Kamsa did?
To the host.
Or what Kamsa did.
Well, Bar Kamsa did. Why are they enemies?
Oh, why are they enemies in the first place?
He says he did anything.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. Right, so we don't, so that's a very good question. We don't know what is the reason why they're enemies in the first place. Here's another question. What is the role of Kamsa in this story?
None.
Literally none.
Well, the Gemara doesn't seem to think so. How do you understand that opening line in the Gemara? Yeah.
I find the essence of this is written in the temple has fallen. This is Talmud, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the essence of this is we were vulnerable, helpless people. And this is a story about we were in charge. It wasn't the Romans. It wasn't anyone else. We were in charge of what happened to us. And in a way, as terrible as this is, we're not helpless. Which is the opposite of actually what they were at that we were at that point. We were stateless, we were beholden to our hosts,
yeah.
The host countries. But this is a story about agency. We're in charge of our own life. Don't blame it on anybody else.
I think that's a very powerful framing for the story.
Can't argue with me.
No, I think it's very powerful. And I think it's very powerful in terms of thinking about the overall theme of this day on virtue, that we are the agents of who we wish to be in the world. And I think so often it's easy to let the way we are with people sort of be defined by the things that are happening in our lives, or so-and-so acted this way with me, and therefore I'm going to act with this way in response. But at the end of the day, how I am with someone is only a result of my own decisions of who I want to be in this world. And you're taking that back in this story. I appreciate that framing.
Excuse
yeah.
me, could you repeat what she said?
Oh, sorry, I just want to repeat the comment. There was a question to repeat it. So if I, you'll correct me if I'm not repeating it correctly, okay?
That's better than the way I said it.
She was just saying that, I wish you would just say it again. Will you say it again, but louder?
What?
Just your original comment.
My friend, she said I forgot.
Me too.
In other words, this was when this was written down. We were stateless. We were beholden to our hosts, the countries where we were. And this is a story of power and control. That, and in fact, we were helpless and vulnerable. But what this is telling you, when this was written down, this is telling you that it's our doing. Whatever happened to us is our doing. And in a way, that's a very positive thing. That we do control events.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the truth of the history of the downfall of the temple, really. But this is what the rabbis took from it.
Yeah.
We control what happens to us.
I think I want to take one more comment. I want to ask you. It sounds just as good. Even better the second time. If I ask you to do it a third time, it's just going to get better, I know. After class. I want to take one more comment on this. I want to ask you a question about part of the story we haven't talked about, and then we have to move on because I actually brought sources that we need to look at that I like. So the person who raises their hand the highest in the back, yeah.
I do think it's interesting that it's the framework of like we talk about like fearing or like Yerushalayim, the idea of like fearing God being like what's preferable and ideally what leads to like ideal results, and like the idea of a hardening of heart, like downfall, et cetera, et cetera. The interesting with the framework of like the reason the first temple was destroyed is like improper like sacrifice and worship and worshiping places that weren't Yerushalayim, which like is a more serious like transgression than like sacrificing animals on the moon, but like it still is within the framework of improper sacrifice. That like sacrificing a blood animal is considered improper sacrifice. So like you could understand the rabbi's hesitance as being like we saw why the first temple was destroyed.
Yeah.
Sacrificed improperly. Like they actually you could see it as like them being afraid, being aware of like possible consequences for like incorrect action and being like we're going to refrain from doing this because like we have the capacity to actually incur Hashem's like you know, anger by doing, which like comes like later in the train of causality after everything happened before Kamsa. But like, I do think it's interesting trying to like reframe the way the like rabbi is acting specifically in the situation of like the calf like with the moon, like whether that actually was them like hardening their heart or not having sufficient fear,
yeah.
Or whether they were actually behaving like pretty reasonably within the context of like past history.
Can I ask one thing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just on the bottom of page 2, the Rabbi Yochanan piece,
yes.
And the humility, because I was thinking about, yes. The context of virtue, there was some humility of Rabbi Zacharias. Like,
I'm not sure I entirely know what they mean by that.
Yeah, that's the question I wanted to ask you. So thank you. So your question doesn't even count because you just stated, yeah, so I want to talk about that last piece in terms of the question of we're still investigating the possible sources of causes of destruction. And Rabbi Yochanan, so you've sort of put forward different theories here. We've a little bit said maybe it's the rabbis for being the bystanders and for not standing up. Clearly, we got to vote for, at the end of the day, it's Bar Kamsa. Everyone else might have been having unintended consequences of your actions. Bar Kamsa knew full well the consequences of his actions. He was trying to cause this major, like he knew what he was doing. So, you know, we talked about the host. What do you think about Rabbi Yochanan's interjection that it's something, and again, it's hard to translate this word. In the English, this translator shows in humility. Other translations have used the word modesty. So I'm curious, how do you understand, what is Rabbi Zacharia ben Achilles' role? And what if he's at fault, what is he at fault for? Yes.
I think one way perhaps to look at it is it's a humility to not use what it seems like the Rabbanan are bringing as a heter to actually do this kafah limum as a sacrifice.
Yeah.
And kind of not being confident enough with the sort of real power to give a heter that seems like a sort of humility or modesty.
That is problematic.
That is problematic because presumably if he had been maybe more confident in the kind of general rabbinic ability
right.
to give a heter on this animal because of the idea of Shalom Malkut, then the whole thing would have ended there. It would have ended that line. The Rabbanan thought to sacrifice it despite the blemish because of Shalom Malkut.
Great. End of story. That would have been one way we could have averted this crisis. Yes. Other comments on it? Yeah.
Signs that show it's over.
Yeah.
So is the whole story something just that illustrates that which caused it in the first place? In other words, they're just illustrating why they're doing it. In other words, is this just an illustration of something that the whole society is gone?
Yeah.
And is pervaded with corruption, whatever. And therefore, what we're getting here is not necessarily the cause at all. Because God, at the end, he suggested God's responsible.
Right.
And he's responsible, obviously, not because he just wants to destroy Jerusalem, because they're not worthy anymore.
Right.
It just shows that they're not worthy anymore.
Great.
What's going on?
Yeah, no, I think that's really important, that in terms of like listing the possible causes of the destruction is God is on the table, God's self, right? Like, we, on the one hand, the Gemara wants to say Bar Kamsa, Rabbi Yochanan wants to say Rabbi Zacharia ben Avkalus, and then at the end of the day, you actually have the Gemara saying, no, it was God all along, and we're going to look at a good source on that. Yeah.
I'm wondering if the whole first part of this story could be a metaphor. If like the banquet is like Israel and Bar Kamsa is the Jews and the host is the Romans and the Jews are like, we'll pay more taxes, please just like let us die. But the Romans don't let them.
Cool. I like it. Let's take one more comment on this and then we're going to look at sources.
Okay, it's just another guess at the word humility.
Yeah.
I don't know if it could be sarcastic, but I mean, Zachary should have said, don't kill humans.
Yeah.
I mean, don't be shy about your advice. It's not just a heter. It's like, just like the rabbis in the original feast did not stand up and say, don't do this to this man. This rabbi is saying, come on, you just suggested killing this guy.
I hadn't thought about that angle before, so I didn't want to say it because I haven't like processed through the story. But I was just thinking about that too, like, who are these rabbis that they're like, well, we could like sort of go either way. Like, we could either sacrifice this animal and like give a heter to the moon, or we could just kill the guy, right? Like, those are equally viable options in the minds of these sages. Yeah, I think that's a fair response. Okay, do you really want the last word on this? No, I'm going to give it to you. Do it, yeah, do it.
Please. Speak on behalf of the rabbis just for a moment.
Oh.
I like that situation, and this man was very suspicious. They sensed that he might have been a traitor. So the idea of killing him isn't so crazy. That is probably where their mindset was. Yet they did nothing, and they just let it happen.
Uh-huh.
Really the crazy part. And that's why I think that this man is really somebody who's paralyzed.
Yeah.
I'm not saying killing the gentleman was the best option, but it wasn't a crazy option. It was a traitor.
Yeah.
To the Romans, who you don't mess with, you know. I mean, you,
yeah.
So that's where they're thinking. This is a dangerous situation they're in.
Yeah. And I think, and I just want to raise this as a question to think about. I think the question of, humility is a major rabbinic virtue. They really like humility. And I think the question of how much humility is a good thing? Is humility always a good thing? Or do we sometimes, are there moments in which we're called to sort of step out of that humility to take another action? I just would sort of pose that to you as a question to think about in your lives as we are working on developing ourselves to be like people who are humble. At what moments, are there moments that humility doesn't actually serve us? Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Certainly, when you look at Hebrew words in the text, it often gives us a clue about what lesson we're supposed to learn. But it's just interesting in English, humility versus humiliate.
Yeah. Oh, fun.
Meaning of that and how that might change the way we look at.
Yeah. That's interesting. Cool. Okay, great. Can I push on? Do you mind? If you still have your comment at the end, you could even insert it into the next section, okay? I just want to make sure we see some more sources, please. Okay, so flip to the next page. We're on part two. Congratulations, guys. An hour in, we've made it to part two. Who's to blame? Survey says Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. This is a fun source that's about the question of why is Kamsa going down for this crime? We all know why Bar Kamsa is possibly responsible for the downfall of the temple, but what is Kamsa's role in this? So this source comes from the Maharal. He's a 16th century rabbi out of Prague. It turns out that all of the sort of like acronym, the later sources that I brought you today, are from the Maharal and the Maharsha. And I didn't know this, which just goes to show how much I don't know, but they're cousins. So I could have more aptly titled this class like the cousins class. So I thought that was actually very neat. So we're gonna first look at the Maharal and then the Maharsha, and we're gonna go back and forth between these two cousins. Does someone wanna volunteer to read the text either in the English or the Hebrew? Yes, please. Yeah, that was you.
I have one of the reading classes on the
computer. Oh, great.
Okay. ויש לך להתכונן, and you have to consider, מה עשה קמצא, ומה פישם, ומה חטאו. What did קמצא do? What was his transgression? What was his sin? שאמר, he said that it should be said, על ידי קמצא, הרם ירושלים, because of קמצא, Jerusalem was destroyed. אבל יש לך לדעת, but you have to know, כי על ידי זה שהיה באותו דור שנאת חינם, but it was because of him, and then he was part of this generation in which there was baseless hatred, ומחלוקת, and division. ודרך המקום, and it says it's human nature, but I would call it God's nature, שיש בו שנאת חינם, שלוקח לו אוהב, לחלוק עם אחר ששונא אותו. It's the nature of the world, that there is baseless hatred, and one person who loves, who has affection, makes a division with another person who hates him. זה שהיה רחמי קמצא, and the fact that he was called קמצא, his friend Kamsa, Zot Ahavatzma, that's the love. That's the friendship. Hu Haluk Peru, that's the source of the division and separation. Ulvicha, and therefore, Haheva Zed, his friend, Nikra Kamsa, it's called Kamsa. She'ein Zer, Rakhi Hit Kasher B'yachad, Kedelach Loki Maharu, because the only reason that he's joined together is to be divided against the other.
What? So what is the Maharal saying about Kamsa's role in the story?
They were clicky.
What'd you say?
They were clicky.
Clicky.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, this is a strange thing to share in front of this group of people, but we're intimate with each other, why not? I remember being in, I think, sixth grade, And I had some friends, like, for whatever stupid reason that friends turned against each other, this, like, this group of friends turned against me. And it was so surreal. I had this, like, profound sixth grader thought of, like, how could it be that they suddenly, like, hate me but are still best friends with each other? But it feels a little bit like this, that, I mean, this is a, I sort of hope I don't want to agree with this, but this is a strong statement to say that, like, whenever people join together, they are joining together sort of to the detriment or to the separation. It's a source of friction for other people. What do you guys think about this idea? Yes.
Well, I'm wondering if Kamsa and Bar Kamsa are just two sides of the same person, like the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Hara.
Mm. And will you take it a step further? And what would that mean?
That in everything we do, there's a conflict between our goodness and our not-goodness.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay, great. Yeah, thank you. Yes.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to what he's saying, and it can be expanded to the rest of the story as well. You know, it's not just Kamsa and the host who created friction by being enemies against Bar Kamsa. It was also Chazal and Rabbi Zacharia who created very firm distinctions that ultimately created a much greater friction between the Jews in Israel and the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of truth to the notion that a lot of when you come together, even if it's out of love for a greater purpose, it necessarily creates friction with others, and its purpose is at least partly to cause separation and friction with others.
Great, thank you. Yes.
So, still haunted by my own sixth grade or seventh grade.
We could form a club.
The same is, and I think a lot of the problems are about optics, right? The Romans care about how this looks, maybe to the Jewish God. The rabbis care about concept. Everybody worries about how it looks,
yeah,
and they worry a lot less about what's the outcome going to be. And I think that's very much true of the social setting that haunts us all. How does this look? Does this outfit look good? Do I fit in?
Yeah.
I think even the party episode when he says, "Look, don't kick me out. I'll pay for the entire party. Just don't make me look bad as I get kicked out of this party."
Yeah.
Anyone who's been walked out of something, that's really unpleasant and really humiliating because it looks bad.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really critical part here that I think he's addressing as well, that as soon as you start worrying about who's literally standing with whom,
yeah,
you know, we've seen that in the news recently, those optics matter a lot.
Yeah.
And plays a huge role.
Great, thank you. Okay, one more comment on the source and then we'll move on. Or, yeah, sure.
It seems like the part about, like, the taking friends to makes an enemy, essentially, it seems like that's to gloss on the whole generation being filled with sinat chinam.
Yes.
And when there's a place where there's sinat chinam, there,
yes,
when one makes a friend, one makes an enemy, which kind of seems like it explains why Kamsa is really responsible, because he says he was a part of the generation where there was sinat chinam. And so it seems like it's just an explanation of what that comment means, what it means that just because Kamsa's here and he was part of this sinat chinam group, that's why kind of there became this enmity between the host, who seems to have no connection between Bar Kamsa,
yeah,
and why Kamsa's now in trouble.
Great. And also I think in terms of tying this back to the theme of the day and to virtue and thinking about our own consequences on the world, I think this powerfully goes to say, like, even in situations where we think we might be having no consequence on the world, like, Kamsa is not even a direct part of the story, and yet this text is asserting, like, no, Kamsa is very much a part of the story. And even in relationships in which we're acting lovingly with one person, that relationship, if we're not really thinking through how might that be affecting other people, that could have trickle effects that we need to be aware of. Yeah, Shani.
I'm thinking about, like, situations I've been in communities where, like, there's a person who did something, like, some people in the community just put up or hurt someone in the community. And then the question about, like, well, now that we socially isolate, but, like, you know, do I invite this person to my party? Do I show up to a party this person is going to be at? Like, how do I interact with them to see them? And suddenly, like, so, like, interaction between two people actually, like, becomes a tricky situation of trying to get, like, is it possible that, like, Bar Kamsa really hurt the host, right? And so Kamsa is in a situation where, like, yeah, he also sort of participating in, like,
sort of siding with the host on this and saying, like, yeah, I'm going to socially isolate you. And then, but then what happens, like, on the flip side when we choose to, like, punish someone?
Great. Okay, let's read another source. So we're gonna go on to section three, who's to blame, survey says the host. So this is coming from the Maharsha, again, cousin of the Maharal, very cool. Polish, 16th century. We're gonna skip the first bolded one and go to the second one, and he went and brought Bar Kamsa, right? So this is that the host sends him to bring Kamsa, and the servant goes and bring Bar Kamsa accidentally. A volunteer to read this source. Yes, thank you.
It's possible, and he went and brought Bar Kamsa. It's possible that this was father and his son, and the messenger made a mistake between them. And also, Bar Kamsa that came, even though he knew that he was his enemy, he thought that because his father was his friend, the father would ask that his friend make peace with him, and for this reason he invited him. This is like that which is written in Maseka Eruvin. Whoever is appeased by his wine, i.e. whoever becomes more relaxed after drinking, has in him an element of the mindset of his creator, who acted in a similar fashion, as it is stated, and the Lord smelled the sweet savor. And the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake.
Wow.
But the host of the meal didn't have the mindset of the creator, and after he mistakenly came to the meal, he said to him, that man is the enemy of this man. How could you mistakenly say that I would invite you when you are my enemy? And despite all of his requests, he paid no attention to him until with force he took his hand and took him out.
What's going on in this text? What do you think? Father and son? Kamsa, Bar Kamsa, right? Bar Kamsa, Bar meaning son of. What does it do to change the story to think about them being father and son? Yeah.
Well, it deals with the first issue about the story, which is that you wonder why Bar Kamsa even went if this guy was his enemy, and this sort of takes care of that question.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so right. It addresses why would Bar Kamsa go? Yeah.
Generational division. It's not immediately take it as representational and zoom out from it, right? It's not that this Hinnom was between individuals necessarily, but it was between divided groups, and those groups divided perhaps for those of one generation or those of another. So the conflict arose out of experience and time.
Great, yes. Thank you, yeah.
I just think it shows even more pride in society that the basis of it isn't just the Nakamim, but it's the family relationship.
Yes.
In the families, there's hatred of this extent that son and father can't basically be in the same room together. And it's actually gives the situation of sympathy for Barakas Hamza because he really thought there was an opening for peace.
Yeah. Yes.
So this society, right down to their family units, is really problematic.
Yeah, this makes the story so tragic for Bar Kamsa. And so he's like, was just hoping that there might be this opening. Yeah, and I did read another source that more specifically really puts the blame on Kamsa. Again, sort of putting forward the idea that it's father and son, but saying like, Kamsa was there. Like, Kamsa knew that his son had been invited and knew that the host would never want him there. Why doesn't the father stand up? And that the father, like the rabbis, doesn't stand up. Yeah.
It's so interesting, I think, it brings in a value that hasn't been addressed as much in the previous sources of like forgiveness or lack thereof. So I feel like in like the original like text in the Bible, it seems like the biggest issue is that of like humiliation.
Yeah.
Of, like, not that like the host had any obligation to treat Bar Kamsa kindly, but that his like sin was treating him so crassly, so like unkindly. But here, like it compares this notion of like Hashem like essentially like forgiving mankind after like the Noahide like sins and then being like, I'll never do this again. And this idea that like Bar Kamsa came like expecting forgiveness and seeking forgiveness and that wasn't granted. And like the humiliation at the end seems almost like an end note. Like that's not like the main part of the source. The idea that like the host not only humiliated him, but was so like deeply unwilling to even consider the possibility of like forgiving or ending.
Great.
Really
And I love that in terms of, again, going back to theme of the day, like, what are the different, what, you know, depending on how we, what is the responsible for the destruction of the story, and what is the different moral takeaway, and what does that teach us about virtue? Yes, that raising the ability to forgive as an important virtue. And then, of course, what happens to Bar Kamsa in that reading, that Bar Kamsa is seeking some sort of opening and forgiveness. He doesn't receive that. He's called Lisha down. And then he himself becomes so hardened that, like, he couldn't possibly overlook this tremendous slay. So, like, the sort of the ramifications of what have someone acts this way in the world, and then I act, and sort of going back to what you said, that at the end of the day, though, we are all agents of our own behavior, and we get to choose who we are in this world. Yes?
I'm sitting here trying to think of a situation and I remember my father at my wedding. My father had a partisan group during the war. And in his shtetl of Yosefov, there was a Jew who gave in his daughter. He was a capo. And at my wedding, all of the landslide, all of the people from his partisan group were invited from all over the world. And they begged him to invite this man who killed his daughter. Begged him. And my father said there was no way he's showing at my daughter's wedding. In the end, he let him come, but he did not talk to him. I don't know what I would have done in his situation. I don't know if I would have been able to forgive this man. And I don't know if in this situation, I don't know what Bar Kamsa has done before, but Bar Kamsa is not a good person. Mm-hmm. And do we always forgive? Did they really know you could project the destruction of the temple? I mean, there were many reasons. This is not the answer, but I think it's tough to imagine what everyone's rejecting him.
Yeah, I very much appreciate your comment, and just draw, you know, sort of like the beauty of the Jewish holiday is that every year we get to approach the same subject sort of with different, from different perspectives. And forgiveness is such a complicated issue, which is why every Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we get to sort of study those same texts of, you are right. On one hand, I think the rabbis definitely think that sort of being sort of easy to forgive is an important virtue. And yet also they are aware that forgiveness is complicated. There are times in which forgiveness can be really difficult, if not impossible. And that's a whole other thing, and you're very much right to raise that. Thank you. Can we, yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna throw a monkey wrench in this whole conversation.
Well, with 5 minutes to go, why not?
Of course, why not? I'm accusing the rabbis of seeing nothing on.
Let's do it.
Why do they blame Kamsa? There's absolutely nothing in the text that indicates that Kamsa has any guilt whatsoever in this story, any more than there's any proof in the text that Ishmael ever was a rapist. Come on. I'm just flabbergasted that they're going out of the way to paint this man with the blackest brush that you can imagine. There is absolutely nothing in the text to indicate that he did anything wrong. This is enough.
You are upset at the Maharal and the Maharshan?
Yes.
Well, what about the Gemara saying that Jerusalem was destroyed on account of Kamsa Bar Kamsa? What about the text itself?
So yeah, but the text does not indicate anything about Kamsa that would support their statement.
But the Gemara says it's destroyed because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa.
Well, then the Gemara is making a mistake.
So you're mad at the Gemara too? I just wanted to be clear which rabbis you were mad at.
The story does not support the contention.
You are. Well, you are right, but I just wanted to point out that internally that question is raised by the Gemara, that the Gemara says Kamsa Bar Kamsa, and you are right that then the story doesn't seem to support what is Kamsa's role, and that's why the later rabbis have to work hard to figure out, but wait a second, what was Kamsa's role in it such that the Gemara went out of its way to say that? So I hear you. Let's read, I think we're going to read one more source and then we're going to call it quits. So let's read the source under who's to blame. Survey says the rabbis, right? While we're already throwing the rabbis under the bus. This is the Maharsha. And he says, because the rabbi sat there and didn't protest, right? This is Bar Kamsa, exactly what David was noting, that it's not, perhaps it's not even just that he was thrown out of the party. Perhaps what he's really upset about is that the rabbis don't stand up and say anything about it. One could say that they didn't protest because they had no power to protest. It's possible they did this because the power of flattery prevailed in that generation, as it's written in Sota with regard to King Agrippus. So the context for that is what does it mean that the power of flattery prevailed in its generation such that it's such a negative thing? That the Jews were like praising King Agrippa, and he was sort of like feeling not included, and they said, don't worry, you're one of us. And they were just like really flattering him. And then the Gemara goes on to be like, what is wrong with these people? Like they're sort of so consumed with like praising the one in power that they're willing to say things that aren't true. And then goes on to say, no one can make judgments in this day because everyone is just speaking flattery for the sake of speaking flattery. So no one is speaking truth anymore. So that it takes this thing of like flattery, which I guess might be positive, and that Gemara and Sota really turns flattery on its head to say that actually like speaking flattery is really just a way of saying things that don't mean anything. And so bringing that back to this text, why do the rabbis not say anything? Possibly because they didn't have the power to protest, or it's possible because of the power of flattery. So what does that mean in our context with our story? Why do the rabbis not say anything? Yeah.
Very rich guy.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I love you,
Jay. I stand down. I think this text is offering two different. On one hand, I think this text is initially saying you could say they didn't say anything because they had no power to protest. It was out of their control. What could they have done? They couldn't have affected change. And then it says, or something more sinister, maybe they didn't protest because they were sort of so consumed with playing the game of power, with keeping the one in power happy, and sort of saying the right things, and they weren't going to be the one to stand up. And that, yeah, please.
So I was going to actually attach that to the question about why, what's the problem with what Rosh Hashanah says, that the word in the Gemara is not anavato, which might be actually kind of more precisely translated as humility, but anavatanuto, which is an abstraction of humility. It's his demonstration of humility. It's his interest in humility.
Uh-huh.
How other people see virtue.
Yeah.
And I think that in fact, what he says to them is not, we don't have the right or the authority to make these decisions. He says, what will other people think about our exertion of our authority to make these decisions? That he's always worried about how he's going to look in public or how they're going to look in their authority in public, which I think is related to this question of chanukah, you could even call sycophancy. That right? It's abasing yourself before power. Who's gonna? What are the consequences for you, and how do you position yourself? And that's the difference maybe between anavato and anavatanuto. That he's always thinking about how he's going to play.
Great. Thank you. So I'm going to just draw us to a close so that we end on time. First of all, I just want to say an incredible note of gratitude for bringing such fresh eyes to this text, for all the conversations, for all the points that you've raised. This as a first public teaching at Hadar, I am grateful to you and thankful to you. I love about this text is it's so easy to point the finger to one person, right? It's so easy to say it's the host's fault. It's so easy to say it's Bar Kamsa's fault. But what we see in this text is there's so many people along the way that could have acted differently, that could have stood up for something, could have exhibited some display of some virtue, and choose not to for whatever reason. And so I think this text just really empowers us to remember that we are all players in all of our interactions. And going back to the question of agency, we can always choose who we want to be in the world and what virtue we want to exhibit. And this text is really calling us to say, we are all responsible for when things seem to be spinning out of control, or there's some sort of chaos around us, to think about what is the role that we have to play in this, and how can we stand up for something. So Yasher Koach, and thank you.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.